Many Americans, perhaps even most Americans, believe that Lee Harvey Oswald did not act alone when he killed President John F. Kennedy on November 22, 1963. Oswald even called himself a patsy just before he, in turn, was assassinated by nightclub owner Jack Ruby. It was a series of events that not only shook America, it also permanently changed the course of American history. Look at it this way. Kennedy wanted to break up the CIA and withdraw from South Vietnam. Had that happened, there would have never been a President Lyndon Johnson, and then no anti-Vietnam War movement. That means that there probably wouldn't have been a President Richard Nixon, and without Nixon, there would have been no Watergate scandal. Without Watergate, Jimmy Carter would have never been president. And without Carter, there would have never been the so-called Reagan Revolution of 1980. Those aren't the only ways in which history would have been different. And John Kennedy's wasn't the only murder that had an impact on history. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. We're going to tell you today about one of the most fascinating unsolved murders in modern American history, and it's one that most Americans know nothing about. I want to try to lay out the characters in this story. One is John F. Kennedy himself. You know all about him. Another is Cord Meyer. He was a school friend of Kennedy's, and many of their mutual friends said that they were best friends. Indeed, best friends until the end of Kennedy's life. Cord Meyer also became one of the CIA's senior-most officers. Another character in this story is Mary Pinchot Meyer, Cord's wife. She, too, was a great school friend of Kennedy's. Mary, Cord, and JFK all went to school together, and in fact, Kennedy and Mary dated each other before Mary and Cord became a couple and got married. That didn't stop JFK and Mary from having an affair, though. That's something we'll talk about a little bit later. Cord Meyer joined the CIA in 1951 at the invitation of CIA Director Alan Dulles. Kennedy was already in Washington, having been elected to the House of Representatives and contemplating a Senate run 3 years later. Cord had a string of senior positions at the CIA, always with Kennedy's support, and the three, along with Jackie Kennedy and Newsweek magazine editor Ben Bradley and his wife Antoinette, who was Mary's sister, were at every society party at every social event in Washington together. The Meyers divorced in 1958, 2 years after their young son Michael was hit by a car and killed near their home. He was 9 years old. Fast forward then to 1963. Kennedy is murdered in Dallas in November. The Meyers are devastated, and Washington and the country are never the same. But life eventually goes on. Mary, who had always been artistic, became one of the leading artists in the Washington Colorist School. That was an important American art movement of the mid-20th century. Her paintings are now worth hundreds of thousands of dollars and are in museum collections around the world. On October 12, 1964, 11 months after Kennedy was killed, Mary decided to go for a walk along the C&O Canal towpath in the Georgetown section of Washington, D.C. That was something that she did almost every single day. She was supposed to then meet her sister for lunch, and then she intended to paint for the rest of the afternoon in her studio, which was behind her sister's property in Georgetown. But Mary never made it. She was brutally murdered while walking along the towpath. Police almost immediately arrested a black man near the scene of the crime, an arrest which racism played a major role. That man was tried for the crime, and then an all-white jury found him not guilty. No other arrests have ever been made, and the case is officially listed as open and unsolved. Our guest today, who was the best friend of the Meyers son who was killed in that car accident, took up the case as an adult. He published an absolutely riveting book about it called Mary's Mosaic: The CIA Conspiracy to Murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Pinchot Meyer, and Their Vision for World Peace. He used primary source CIA and U.S. Army documents to get to the bottom of it. And spoiler alert, he solves the crime. And he points the finger directly at the CIA. We are very happy today to welcome Peter Janney to the show. Peter is a PhD psychologist, He's a renowned author and a university lecturer. Peter, thank you so much for being with us. This is a real treat.
My pleasure, John. I am just really thrilled that the excitement around this story and this book has captivated you and hopefully will continue to captivate your audience.
Amen to that, Peter. Let's start with the players in this complicated story. I hope that I did them justice in the introduction, but tell us about Cord and Mary Meyer, their relationship to John and Jackie Kennedy, and to Ben and Antoinette Bradley. These people were all at the very top of Washington society in the 1950s and the 1960s, and these were the circles in which your own parents were traveling.
Yes. All of the people that you just mentioned not only socialized together, but their kids, became friends and they went to the same schools in Washington, private school, particularly one called Georgetown Day School, which is quite well known right now. And, they had a gay old time in Washington. And of course, that included quite a lot of drinking, and it took its toll.
But tell us a little of your own personal history. You lived near the Myers when you were a child. Their middle son, Michael, was your best friend. And then he was killed when he was hit by a car while trying to cross the street. You remained close to the Myers into your young adulthood, and then when you were 17 years old, you came home from school during a break, and your parents told you that Mary had been murdered. That affected you deeply. Tell us about that event and about how it spurred you to write this outstanding book.
Yes, it did. You know, the event itself shocked me. You know, I remember sitting at our dinner table the night before Thanksgiving in the fall of 1964. And my mother just sort of casually made an announcement as to the event of this murder. Here I was home from boarding school. I was in the 11th grade. I was planning to go out and have a gay old night. And I ended up retreating to my bedroom and going to bed literally right after dinner and crying most of the night off and on. I knew there was something very profound that had taken place. And I was also for many years haunted by the scene at our dinner table because my mother did all the talking and my father just vacantly stared off into space, which I thought was kind of unusual, given, how critical this event was. So it stayed with me for many years. And it was only through a course of intensive psychotherapy. And since we were in the got into the late 1960s, the ritual use of psychedelics in a very responsible way, that I started making the connections that I needed to make that allowed me to advance this story to where the ultimate end result was the book. And that took many years.
Well, tell us about the relationship between Mary Meyer and John Kennedy. The National Enquirer tabloid broke the story in 1976, well after both of them were dead. But now it's generally accepted as fact. Did you find proof of that relationship in your own research?
Oh, unequivocally. Mm-hmm. I think the thing, to begin is that the first time JFK laid eyes on Mary was at a prep school winter festivities dance. JFK had gone to the Choate School, a very posh, elite prep school in Wallingford, Connecticut. And he had already graduated But he came back the following year just to go to this big hotshot weekend there where there was this formal dance, that kind of thing. And this was where he first laid eyes on Mary. And it was an encounter he could not forget. Mary's date was a man by the name of William Atwood, who actually became a member of Kennedy's administration. He was one of Kennedy's ambassadors. But there are a number of references to the three of them sitting around at, subsequently coming together and reminiscing about when they were together at this dance. And so Bill Atwood kept running upstairs to gargle Listerine. He had a very bad cold. And during that time is when JFK started to make his moves on Mary in terms of cutting in on her and on Atwood and things like that. But, you know, Mary kind of took it with a grain of salt. She recognized JFK at that time for who he was, you know, a very wealthy playboy who was just on the make. And, you know, it didn't really interest Mary. He didn't interest Mary, really. But definitely, he was very just taken with her and never forgot the times. Now, fast forward into the late 50s, early 60s, and they ended up being neighbors. JFK and his wife Jackie were first to occupy Hickory Hill, subsequently where Bobby and Ethel and their family lived after JFK and Jackie moved into Georgetown. So there was a lot of, you know, interaction at that time. I think the thing to remember here is that the trauma of the Myers, and particularly Mary, losing their middle son to a car accident where Michael was hit kind of at dusk coming home for dinner. And that was 1956 in December. And so Mary was devastated. And I think that was really one of the primary things that kept a divorce or stimulated a divorce to take place. Because Mary was also increasingly very turned off of Cord's work at the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. She just didn't like it. She hated Alan Dulles, and she was just appalled about hearing a number of things that they were involved in.
Peter, I want you to hold that thought. We are going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Peter Janney about his investigation into Mary Myers' murder and the exciting culmination of all of those efforts. Stay tuned. Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with Dr. Peter Janney. He's a psychologist, a renowned author, and a university lecturer. Peter, thanks again for being with us.
My pleasure.
Peter, let's get into the details of Mary Myers' murder. Mary went for a walk along the C&O Canal in Georgetown like she did almost every day. She was going to have lunch with her sister and then paint, but she never made it to the lunch. Take it from there.
Well, Mary's walks on the C&O towpath were a regular part of her routine. She typically went to her studio around 8 in the morning. She would work for 3 or 4 hours and then go take a walk down into Georgetown from where her studio was, which was about 6 blocks, and then go under Key Bridge and walk out the towpath to a place called Fletcher's Boathouse. So to go out to Fletcher's and back was about 2 miles, maybe 2.5 mile walk. And it was, as I said, a very established routine. Mary, you know, she, as a woman in her early 40s, she was very physically fit. She played a lot of tennis. She took exercise very seriously. So this was, you know, a routine that she really enjoyed and would, you know, keep it up even on the coldest days in winter. And there's a little story in my book about one day she walked into Jackie Kennedy. This was post-assassination. And the two of them just embraced and cried together. And it's a very poignant moment, I think, in the story, in terms of, even though Mary and JFK were having an affair, which I really think Jackie knew about, as well as any number of sexual encounters Jack had during his career, you know, the two of them had a bond that was above and beyond conflict, just in terms of their respect and connection and, you know, deep abiding faith in who JFK was at the time and the tragedy that had taken place in Dallas.
One of the absolute craziest parts of this story is that of Mary's diary. She kept a diary, and she told her sister and brother-in-law about it and asked them to destroy it in the event that something happened to her. Then immediately after her death, the Bradleys were in their home, and they heard somebody in Mary's studio behind the house, and Ben Bradley went to investigate. So tell our viewers what happened next.
Well, actually, there needs to be a correction here. The way the Bradleys knew about the diary was through Mary's best friend, Ann Truitt. Mm. And on the night, Ann Truitt was in Japan the day of the murder. And on the evening of the murder, she actually called the Bradleys, and she was looking for Jim Angleton, who, as many people know, was the chief of counterintelligence
at the CIA.
And she wanted to inform everyone that there was this diary. They needed to find it because there were a lot of very fascinating details that were in the diary, and that Anne did not want to see this information get into the wrong hands. So what happened at that point is Bradley and Angleton went to Mary's diary, and Bradley had the key to the entrance. So they went into Mary's gallery and found the diary. And of course, Bradley gave it to Angleton to, quote unquote, take care of it. And so it was Angleton who actually knew about the diary already because he was having Mary's phone tapped. He knew who Mary was and what she was capable of. And we're talking about a moment that is just, you know, in September of 1964, the Warren Commission mm-hmm. had been written and released. Mary had her own copy, which she read and just infuriated her to no end. And it was at that point she was planning to go public and basically tell the world of her relationship with JFK and what had happened, and she was going to blow the whistle on the CIA, particularly her ex-husband, and of course, Jim Angleton. So that became really the motivating factor as to why the CIA felt they just had to get rid of her. She was going to just destroy all the publicity that was going into the Warren Commission report, and trying to put the public at rest that, of course, it was Lee Harvey Oswald, when in fact she was already convinced that it wasn't.
You used primary source documents from the CIA and from the U.S. Army that allowed you to focus on one person, a man that you believe to be Mary Meyer's killer. Now, this is the thing to me, this is what sold me on the book. Who was that man, and what led you to him?
The name of the man was Lieutenant William L. Mitchell. And Mitchell was an undercover contract agent for the CIA. He started to develop a habit, which he was instructed to do, of being out on the towpath around the time Mary took her walk. And so on the day of the murder, he was actually the last person to see her. Now, originally, I thought Mitchell was the assassin, but given the nature of Mitchell's personnel record, which my researchers helped me get released along with an attorney, we got his personnel file and examined it, and Mitchell did not have a profile of a CIA assassin. Had he been a CIA assassin, there would have been certain entries in his personnel file of having training here, having training there. They weren't there, but Mitchell is a very credible, critical person in this story, because going deeper into this web, it occurred to me that there was a CIA assassin. And these people, as you probably might imagine, they're like ghosts. I mean, they come in, they do the work, and then they just completely disappear and vanish. Yes. And there is not a trace of them. I don't think Mitchell was the assassin. And one of the reasons that leads me to this is I filed a lawsuit against Mitchell. I had to get to him in some way. And in order to get rid of the lawsuit, Mitchell's attorney agreed to a deposition, that I would have a 3-hour deposition with Mitchell out in California, whereby I could ask him questions that he had never been asked before. And of course, it would be recorded and annotated and written up, that kind of thing. So we went to the deposition, and Mitchell was unaware of my level of preparation, as most people are. And so I basically caught Mitchell with his pants down on a number of details. And it was very clear through the deposition that he was lying. At one point, when we took a break, my attorney was very anxious. And I said, "David, you know, what's going on here?" He said, "Look, Peter, this is the guy who will come back with a loaded gun and shoot us all.
Right.
That's what I'm worried about." Mm-hmm. Of course, that did not happen. But, you know, I think that deposition really took the case several steps further, deeper.
Yeah.
To really show that there was an immense amount of organization around this operation, mm-hmm. to get rid of Mary, mm-hmm. Meyer. And it had to look a certain way, or else the suspicion was just going to totally derail what the intelligence people wanted to achieve in this operation. And go ahead.
Peter, I apologize that we're out of time, and I want to thank you for being with us on the show, and I want to encourage everybody to take a look at this absolutely magnificent book, Mary's Mosaic. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, John.
Author Robert Persig said in his famed book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, "The truth knocks on the door and you say, 'Go away, I'm looking for the truth,' and it goes away. Puzzling. But that's what so many Americans have done as others have searched for the truth in some of the most traumatic and historically important events of the 20th century. That's why we are so fortunate to have people like Dr. Peter Janney out there researching, writing, and not being afraid of the truth. I'd like to thank Peter Janney for being with us today. Please, again, check out his book, Mary's Mosaic, The CIA Conspiracy to Murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Pinchot Meyer, and Their Vision for World Peace. I'd also like to thank our viewers for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. Please follow me on Substack @John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.